Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, an about-face in the design of downtown as Jacksonville begins changing one-way streets to two. We discuss the reasons behind the change and its expected impacts. Later in the program, how a new federal ban on non-compete clauses will impact employees and their bosses. A labor lawyer joins us to answer your questions. But first, a project restoring two-way traffic on two downtown thoroughfares is underway. The effort begins with Adams and Forsyth Streets, but will eventually expand throughout much of the downtown core. To discuss it, we're joined by Jacksonville Daily News staff writer Rick Anderson, who has been covering this issue. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
And Lori Boyer, CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Rick, let's start with a basic overview of what is happening right now and what is being proposed.
Well, so I know that Lori can give much more in-depth information on this, but the basics are that for Adams and Forsyth Streets, which are now one-way, those will become two-way streets again. They will be restored to two-way traffic between Jefferson and Liberty Streets.
And that process has begun in the sense that there's crews out there? What's happening?
They are doing some preliminary work. They're installing some infrastructure for signals and also doing some pavement work, as I understand it.
And so, Lori, this is a multi-million dollar, multi-year project. For those who don't know what the relationship of the Downtown Investment Authority is with the city, though, give us a little reminder of what DIA does.
Big picture. DIA is responsible for redevelopment activities within downtown and creating the master plan. So that would be everything from infrastructure, retention ponds, two-way street conversions, parks, to the, and I mean planning of them, not executing and building them. And then also individual property dispositions of city-owned property and approving incentives for private redevelopment activities. So kind of broad, big picture.
And so the two-waying of streets, which has begun, has been a priority for a long time. I mean, I was looking back at some stories with, you know, names and agencies that don't even exist anymore. Ron Barton and Terry Lawrence and the JEDC. So this long predates your tenure.
I first see it, and it may go before that, but there is a 2005 or 7 action plan that Bob Rhodes was the chair of the committee that lists the priority of various streets downtown, and Laura Street was the first, and Laura Street was executed, as you know. I don't know if Laura Street was one way prior to that, or this was just a traffic calming measure on Laura Street, but after that, they had predicted that they were going to move or hoped they would move to the next project by 2009-10, and obviously none of that happened. So from DIA's perspective, we continued with that priority. I can tell you that Andre Wallace, when he was CEO of Downtown Investment Authority, had approached City Council in, I think, 2016, trying to get these added to the city's capital improvement program. City did not do that. They did not get included. So DIA, about 2018-19, decided that, okay, the North Bank Tax Increment District, we could start saving revenue on a, you know, year-by-year basis till we accumulated enough funds to be able to do the project. And hence the reason the design started probably in 21, and we are finally under construction, long-awaited construction.
So as I recall, Rick, the idea on Laura Street those many years ago was actually implementing these almost like cobblestone segments in the intersections to slow you down. There's almost like little rumble strips that you drive over. Mm-hmm. But what is the idea behind this? Is slowing things down the goal?
Well, I think that partly it's slowing things down. I also think partly it's to promote some more activation, some more pedestrian activity, some more bicycle activity. Greater mobility, you know, one-way streets are the reason that two-way streets were converted to one-way was kind of back in this Mad Men era of traffic engineering where the idea was to get people out of and into the city from the suburbs and treat downtown more like a workplace kind of than a marketplace or a community or a neighborhood. And the goal of the bigger, broader goal, I think, of two-way conversion is to bring that back, you know, turn downtowns more back more into a walkable, bicyclable, you know, if you want to take a ride share, you can do that. But yeah, get some more activation and get some more pedestrians and bicyclists out and make it safer for them.
Lori, what does the research show about two-way streets and what benefits they have for cities?
There are really three policy reasons to do it. The first one is economic development. The one-way conversions both made traffic faster and also made retail die on the street front. So from the standpoint of cars going quickly with synchronized signals and getting out of downtown as fast as possible, you no longer look side to side to see what shop was there. So the visibility of street front retail greatly declined. And also, so that was part of it. And what you see from a data standpoint is, I think there's a study from Louisville and there's a couple others where they see significant increases in property value once the conversion is made and in occupancy of the street front retail. Second reason is safety. The slower speeds within and the changing from 12-foot wide lanes and 30 or 40 mile an hour expected speed limits when you can have synchronized signals down to 15 or 20 mile an hour streets within a core neighborhood is something that greatly enhances both pedestrian and bicycle safety and vehicular safety. It also limits the number of crashes. And then the third reason is one that kind of is looking at how you navigate and how you get around downtown. So finding your way to a parking space, finding your way to a parking garage, now that we can have apps that show where things are available, how do you actually get there? Do you have to go two blocks and then turn right and go two blocks in order to get to that parking space? So that's another reason that advocates have been converting them. And you're seeing it in Orlando right now. Tampa's doing it. Palafox Street in Pensacola was one of the first about 10 years ago, which is a real success story.
So there are some identified benefits. And yet at the same time, you know, the idea that holistically you're going to say we're going to slow traffic in the core city sounds a little bit nuts.
Well, but think about it. It's a very limited segment. And what we are doing is we're retaining the one-way pairs that take you to the bridges. So in traffic lingo, you refer to fast streets as arterials. And what you've got is Main and Ocean that take you from the Main Street Bridge to and from the Main Street Bridge to State and Union Streets. And then you've got Jefferson and Broad that take you from the Acosta Bridge to the interstate. And then we also still have one-way pairs that take you to I-1095 as it's curving around downtown. So we still have ways to move traffic quickly. All we're saying is within, I think there's no place that's more than four blocks in the two-way section before you get to one of those one-way pairs. So it's really just in a very local segment that you'll have slower traffic.
And yet, I know from covering the courthouse that there is a period every day outside on Adams Street where traffic is just kind of like a parking lot, Rick. Are people receptive to the idea of it possibly getting even slower?
Good question. I haven't spoken to anyone about that issue particularly. I know that in other cities, you know, there are critics of two-way conversions or two-way restorations, just like there are critics of everything. But, you know, some of the concerns that I have heard about it are that, you know, if it's a one-way street, then if you're a pedestrian, you really only have to look one way for traffic. On the other hand, as Lori said, I mean, there are studies out there that indicate that it is a safer configuration. The other concern that I've had is that it makes it a little more difficult for emergency vehicles to get up and down streets if there's more traffic congestion.
And that is a fact, right, Lori? I mean, it could be more difficult for emergency vehicles to maneuver.
The traffic lane width is still being designed with adequate width to cover those, and they're still on street parking, which provides you some additional relief in places that vehicles can pull off and get out of the way. And it's not every block. Again, I mean, there are one way, there are streets that are being converted, and then there are streets that are not. So, for example, Bay Street still has 5 lanes on Bay Street. I mean, it is not restricted in any way. So the fact that if you go up a block and you have Forsyth or Adams that are narrower, people can find those wider streets if they want to move more quickly.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about plans to restore two-way traffic to downtown streets. And you can join our conversation on social media. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can call us at 904-549-2937. We have a message on X from Brian saying, what's next? Free parking. Any plans for free parking?
No. There's free parking nights and weekends right now. And there's no plan to change that because we are encouraging people to come downtown for events and participate in those activities. However, free parking is contrary to kind of the efficient use of parking garages. What we really want to see is employees park in parking garages and leave the on-street spaces available for those visiting retail establishments or those who have to make a quick stop somewhere. And what happens is the lower the price is on the on-street spaces, we have a good example on River Place Boulevard where people will choose not to park in a garage and take up the on-street space and go to work all day. And that's not the goal. That's not what the on-street is for.
So I want to ask about bike lanes because the map that I've seen of the road conversions, and as you said, there's other streets that are eventually going to be converted. Duval Bay, Ashley, Monroe, Church, Julia, among those streets that are designed for two-way. But on the map I saw, I only saw designated bike lanes highlighted in green on Hogan. Are there plans for, you know, bike improvements, bike lanes designated?
Absolutely. So originally the comp plan and our plan, the old one from 2014, had a dedicated bike lane. So they run north, south, and east, west in about every 4 blocks. And originally there was one on Bay Street. However, the U2C required a dedicated lane.
That's the
JTA's autonomous vehicle.
Yeah.
And when DIA agreed to allow that one lane to be taken out, the bike lane off of Bay had to be eliminated. That we might be able to do it in the future, but at this point we cannot. So we have the Riverwalk, and then we have Monroe Street, and then we have Beaver Street running east-west. And from a north-south perspective, you've got McCoy's Creek, the Emerald Trail La Villa link that's going to open on May 6th. And then you have Hogan Street and then Liberty Street, which is a DIA-funded project, and then Hogan's Creek, where you have a trail coming down A. Philip Randolph. So all of those kind of segments connect.
I've got a couple calls I want to get to here. Eugene, good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning. I appreciate the concept that's being proposed, and I hope it will. It's well and going through. But one of my concerns is to the panel, and good morning to all, how is the training going to go? Because being a non-native of Jacksonville, when I first came, I had to get used to the one-way ism. So now it's going to a two-way. How are we going to get people to rethink not to use the street as a one-way versus a two-way?
A good question, Eugene. How are people going to retrain?
Well, I have two answers to that. One is in terms of the actual execution from a traffic engineering standpoint, that's really between Public Works Traffic Engineering and the contractor. When they open it up, how they open it up in segments, how they notify people. But DIA, from our perspective, also is implementing a project on wayfaring signage this year, that the whole idea would be now that we're converting to put signs on those streets that indicate this way to a public parking garage, this way to get to the stadium, et cetera. So filling in where you previously didn't have that signage.
Got a call, John. Welcome to First Coast Connect. Go ahead.
Hey, so I'm actually a resident of 11 East, and parking is already atrocious to begin with. Our residence gives us one parking spot, and we have to pay for it in our garage. It's like $200. But for people who have, more than one person in a house, we then have to pay $200 to $300 for another parking garage that could be six blocks away. I've tried a city owned parking garages and my car got broken into. And there's no actual like video security. It's ridiculous. Anytime there's an event, we just can't find parking. We have to plan our day out to where we're just not gonna be able to park on the streets. Any event, I mean, and the being one ways right now, it's already a cluster. So if you do a two way, we're donezo. It's impossible. This is ridiculous. It does not take into account residents who live downtown where it's already a problem.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. What do you say to that, Lori?
Well, I would say, I mean, this is interesting to hear that residents are relying on on-street parking as a parking solution. That is new. I was not aware of that. But if they are relying on other garages, one of the things we've advocated for and continue to is to have those garages multi-purpose during daytime and nighttime so that there would be parking available for residential parking in the evenings when the office use is not there. And in fact, to the city-owned garage issue, I totally agree with the caller. And we have now installed CCTV cameras in all of the city-owned garages. I think the last one is going to be completed this year, which will be monitored so we can deal with that security issue at night. We want those to be available. And frankly, I would like to be able to make those available to not just retail operations, but to residents and others at a reduced rate for evening parking, because you already have the parking and you already have businesses that use it during the day. So
should it not be incumbent on businesses and residences downtown, though, Rick, to provide affordable parking for people who are using it?
Oh, boy. That's a policy issue that I think is best left for Lori and the decision makers here in town.
Well, what about that, Lori?
Well, so most of the developments feel that they need to do that from a market rate standpoint. What you'll see, and sometimes to our chagrin, is new parking garages being built as part of multifamily rental properties because they feel the need to provide their tenants with parking. But there are some, Barnett being one, that doesn't have associated parking and still has a wait list for tenants. And they do have several places where their tenants park within downtown. Similarly, the new Gateway project is proposing to use parking that is existing, that's a block or two away. And I think that it is not unusual in urban areas. It is inconvenient if you don't have at least one space next to your unit or close.
We've got a call from Kate in the Rail Yard District. Good morning, Kate. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question is specifically, right now it's one way on Forsyth between Noonan and Ocean. And what are you going to do when the artists are loading and unloading their equipment? It's already impossible to get through right now.
At the Florida Theater. Yeah.
So there will still be a loading zone area for Florida Theater, and they will have the ability to use that next to the curb. So all the parking spaces are eliminated in that area when they are loading and unloading. And they also, around the corner, do a lot of their loading and unloading on that. So that is not being changed or eliminated as part of this.
We have an email from Jay. He says, meanwhile, because of on-street parking, the conversion of one-way streets in Riverside Avondale to two-way streets has created an extremely unsafe situation with streets often nearly impossible to travel down for ordinary traffic, much less emergency vehicles. So, I mean, there are other areas of town that have converted. I think of Post Street in Five Points, which is obviously a very animated, pedestrian friendly. And yet when I'm driving a car, I tend to try to avoid it if I can.
I know that Post and College Streets converted in, I think it was 2006. And I haven't run accident details on those. I don't know if that increased the number of traffic accidents or lowered it. I can just tell you from experience, because I live in Avondale and I travel those streets, and I actually am a runner, so I run those streets and I bicycle, that I find that, you know, cars really do slow down. You know, I think it's human nature that if you're approaching another car, you know, you slow down because you see that as a possible accident waiting to happen. So I personally haven't seen any accidents there, but I have only been here 2 years. And like I said, I haven't run the numbers on those.
And the design is very different because these are much wider from curb to curb. than what you're talking about on Poston College. Those are much narrower streets. So it's a much tighter situation with car doors swinging into travel lanes. I mean, and that is true there. Not at all true in the design for the downtown because we had such wide travel lanes.
And so, you know, this trend that went from two-way streets, all cities were basically designed with two-way streets. Many, many cities went to one-way streets. Is there any way to quantify, you know, the harm that that did to downtowns, or is that just, I'm not even sure. Is it, or is it some cities it's worked and better than others?
The data that I see from planning studies, right, where is pretty consistently the preference to return to two-way, except on what we call those, you know, those thoroughfares, right, where you need to get people to interstates, to out of downtown, to returning to their neighborhood after work. So there are appropriate places for those faster, broader, synchronized signal streets. And then there are appropriate places in between where not everything has to be one way. And I think that's really kind of what you see in the data. But other than the study out of Louisville about property values, and I've seen studies that are crash data studies, that it's better when you restore the two-way traffic. And clearly there are studies about bicycle pedestrian safety that indicate it's better. I have not seen, you know, kind of a global study on the impact of the one-way conversions and what it did to downtowns.
So what is the timetable, Rick, for this particular initial phase, Forsyth and Adams, and then what's the vision going forward?
The immediate timetable, I think, and Lori, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the actual conversion is going to, or the restoration is going to happen this summer.
I think it'll be before the end of the year.
Yeah.
They are installing conduit now. Then the signals come in, and I think that's like late summer when the signal devices come in that they have to install. These streets will be changing from parking meters to pay kiosks. So you can still use the app, but in addition, there won't be a meter at every space. There will be a kiosk on the block as opposed to that. Again, kind of encouraging folks to transition to the app versions and the pay-by-plate versions rather than the walk up and put coins in a meter. And then we're going to proceed right ahead with what we call phase two. And phase two starts looking at, so the actual change in traffic by the end of the year. And then phase two looks at select blocks where we add some, bump out the curb, remove some parking spaces, add some trees, create some additional space for sidewalk cafes, things like that, once we have converted the traffic.
We have a call from Stanley. Good morning, Stanley. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning to everybody. Ms. Boyer, it's good to speak with you again. But I'm a little appalled by the move that y'all are making downtown. Me and John Noonan, we walk all through downtown 4 days a week. Yes. And that's not a priority. That's something that can be done 5 years from now. But right now, we got other issues that are not being addressed. And in closing, I like to say this. We continue to spend money, but we don't see no improvement, especially downtown. Thank you.
Thanks, Stanley. This is designed to be a more walkable plan for the city and presumably boost the fortunes of people who are doing business on the street there. But it's not obviously a universally beloved idea.
True. And I think that is consistent with pretty much almost anything you change or develop. And some of it is not seeing it. As we started out the conversation, this is not a new plan. This has been on the books for decades. And as a result, once you see it, and once you see retail spaces reopening, by the way, we had three new restaurants that came in at our last board meeting last month, and we have a couple more this month. So we're seeing it. But when we see it on our side, at the application side or the start of a project, it's 2 or 3 or 4 years before the public sees it.
Right. All right. Well, we'll be continuing to watch this as the roads change back to two ways. It'll be an interesting project to track. Thank you both for being here. Lori Boyer, Rick Anderson, appreciate it.
Thank you.
And up next, what does a new federal ban on non-compete agreements portend for workers and their bosses? A local labor lawyer answers your questions.
Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5. For service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fair promotion. Want to move ahead, but the boss won't seem to let me. I swear sometimes that man is out to get me. They let you dream just to watch them shatter.
Welcome back. Some 30 million people a year in the U.S. are prohibited from changing jobs to work for perceived competitors. But that may no longer be the case. Last week, the Federal Trade Commission banned so-called non-compete agreements in all but a few cases. And here to talk about the opportunities and implications is James Poindexter. He's a labor and employment lawyer here in Jacksonville. Been on the program before. Welcome back, James.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start... Well, I want to get to the recent FTC ruling in a minute, but I want to start by asking, because this really blew my mind, that employees of Jimmy John's were once required to sign non-compete agreements, meaning that they could not work at a competing sandwich shop within 3 miles of a Jimmy John's for at least 2 years.
That's right. So it's an example I use a lot to explain how non-competes, which were intended to restrict unfair competition, have really been overly applied by businesses to restrict even fair competition. I think for someone who's making a sandwich at Jimmy John's behind plated glass while we all stand there and watch, what's the trade secret? What exactly are they preventing their competitors at Subway from knowing that couldn't be gleaned from any member of the public? And I think that's why New York and Illinois, the attorney general stepped in and sued and reached an agreement that the franchise could no longer do that.
And so that has been litigated away, although I saw at one time there was a study done that found that basically it meant if you worked at a Jimmy John's, there would be 6,000 square miles in 44 states in the District of Columbia where you could not work, an effective work blackout, and that someone who'd worked at a Jimmy John's couldn't work in a similar role in the entire city of Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of this comes down, is it wasn't necessarily within 2 or 3 miles of your Jimmy John's. It was from any franchise location. Remember, this isn't a chain. It's not like the employees would go and travel from store to store and work like you see in some other industries. Again, what exactly is the Coca-Cola secret recipe at Jimmy John's that they're so desperate to prevent?
So let's talk about what happened last week. The Federal Trade Commission issued this ruling. How long has it been in the works? And what are some of the implications?
Sure. So over a year ago, the FTC announced that they were considering this. We actually saw a similar memorandum come out of the National Labor Relations Board over a year ago. And they invited public comment. They proposed the rule just like they are allowed to do and like they're required to do with their delegated authority from Congress. You can imagine the outpouring of comments that they received from businesses on one side, from industry experts on the other side, ultimately released this final rule. So it doesn't go into effect for 120 days from when it was published. So it's been about a week now. So we're waiting to see if an injunction gets entered to stop it, which I'm anticipating at this point. And then we'll see it litigated most likely all the way to the Supreme Court.
So we talked about the Jimmy John's example. That's kind of an outlier, but who typically is covered by non-compete agreements?
Sure. So I can speak to the law here in Florida, and the law in Florida, the way it's written is that all restraints on trade, such as non-compete agreements, are illegal. That is the way the law is written. There is a narrow exception that's very narrow that's supposed to apply to only those who have what is called a legitimate business interest. So access to trade secrets and extremely confidential information, very close, you know, relationships with customers, the types that would cause them to be able to pull customers away from someone. Goodwill, specialized training is another one, highly specialized training, not just on the job, this is where the copy machine is, this is where the coffee maker is. And so the law is really written in a way that's supposed to say, these are anti-competitive. These are potentially violations of the antitrust statute. It's bad for the economy. It's against the law unless you fit within this narrow exception. And of course, the way industry has done it is everybody fits within that narrow exception, not just those people who could leave with the Rolodex that could sink the company within 6 weeks of departing.
I mean, and the idea behind this would be, you know, if you're developing a product, for instance, with another person, and the day before it launches, they leave and start their own company and launch the identical product, or some kind of really, you know, being able to peel away clients, for instance, if you're, you know, have a, as you say, a Rolodex of people, and by leaving, essentially take away business from the place you left.
That's right. And that's the academic argument behind it. Now, where the rubber hits the road, California has effectively outlawed all non-competes and has been that way for a long time. I don't think anybody would say that they're having trouble coming up with trade secrets and that sort of thing over there, because there's other laws on the books. For instance, there's the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which prevents you from stealing trade secrets. That's already established as a valid law that restrains trade that's outside of non-competes.
That's a federal law?
There's a federal law on that. There's one in Florida.
What does it provide for?
So it basically it says, look, if you have something that's truly a trade secret, you can't engage in nefarious activity in order to steal that trade secret away from a company, whether it's corporate espionage, and those are the types of things. But you can imagine an employee who copies the schematics for the new technology and goes down the street to the competitor is going to find themselves on the business end of a lawsuit. Those laws are already on the books. There's duty of loyalties that have been known in Florida law long before the non-compete statute existed, where an employee owes a duty to their employer not to do anything that harms them while they're employed there. Confidentiality provisions. There's other tools in an employer's tool chest other than just restricting competition.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impacts of a new ban on non-compete clauses that was approved last week by the Federal Trade Commission. We're talking with labor lawyer James Poindexter, and if you have questions or comments, you can call us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social. James, I entered the broadcast side of this industry, you know, about 15 years ago after working in print for a long time, and I was really surprised to see that there are non-competes very widely accepted in that industry. And it seems that it makes some sense, for instance, if you were like an anchor and you were going to switch from one station to the neighboring station, that that would be confusing and upsetting, I guess, to people at the old station. But why so broadly in an industry like that?
So on the one hand, I think we've been sort of trained to believe that, right? We've sort of been conditioned to say, yes, that's unfair that someone could leave and take their personality that's been built up in the community and go and use it with a competitor. But isn't that good for the economy? The idea that if I'm fed up with what's going on at this employer, whether it be low wages, bad working conditions, or in some cases, illegal conduct, that I can now say, okay, I'm going to leave this bad business and go work for a good business and make more money and work for an ethical company. And that's how the market is supposed to work itself out. The way these agreements are written instead say, no, you're stuck working for this illegal, you know, company or this unethical company, or you have to go find a whole new career at whatever stage of life you're in. And quite frankly, it puts the burden back on the employers to want to attract good people, to want to keep a good culture climate. And I think to a certain degree, that's the pushback that we're getting from the business community is saying, you know, we like being able to restrict the ability of employees to leave just because they're unhappy or they want to negotiate better terms. And I think that's where the National Labor Relations Board stepped in.
The pushback that this has received, I mean, I think even before it was approved, and it was a close vote, we should say, 3-2,
I think.
3-2. I'm sorry.
Something like that. Yeah. It was because, you know, the presidents get to appoint members of the commission. And so President Biden was able to appoint some new folks. And then, you know, the vote was pretty much on party lines. So.
But even before that happened, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had said that they were going to sue. And that's right. I believe they did within 24 hours or something.
They did. Essentially, the next day they filed a suit in Texas. And they have not announced that they're seeking an injunction yet, but they've got plenty of time to file a motion for an injunction, which would effectively stop the law from going to effect.
And what is the nature of their claim?
Great question. So there's sort of two principles here. This was not something that was passed by Congress, and the Constitution makes it fairly clear that, you know, when you're regulating, you know, interstate commerce, that that's something that Congress is entitled to do. Now, there is a delegation of congressional lawmaking authority and rulemaking authority to administrative agencies. The FTC is one of those agencies. And the FTC was really established to deal with antitrust laws and to write regulations to prevent monopolies from coming back into our economy and wreaking havoc like they did early on. And so the challenge from the Chamber of Commerce is saying they exceeded that delegated authority, that they went beyond what Congress has enabled them to do by touching on this question.
We have a call from Daniel in San Marco with a question. Good morning, Daniel. Go ahead. You there, Daniel?
Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. So my question was, if this new FTC rule holds up, is there any thinking that it could be retroactively applied to workers who are already under contract with non-compete clauses in their contract?
Good question, Daniel.
Great question. So the law or the rule specifically addresses that. Anybody who has a non-compete in effect right now, an employer is actually required to send them a letter or notify them that their non-compete will not be enforced. The only non-competes, the only exception to that is for management employees who make more than about $150,000 a year, and those are only going to be effective if they were entered into before the date goes into effect.
So the FTC estimates that 18% of the U.S. workforce is covered by non-compete agreements. They say that's 30 million people, or about one in five. And I was shocked to see that it's that many.
And I think that that speaks to why this came out. I mean, there, and again, you can imagine some situations where these types of agreements might be necessary. And I think if employers were a little bit more judicious in the way that they had used them, we wouldn't be here. But instead, we are having people who are entry level hourly employees who are having to sign these types of agreements, or in industries where there really is no legitimate interest, but it's just a way of preventing good old-fashioned competition that's good for the economy, that they're seeing the administrative blowback here.
And what is the argument? Is it purely economics that the FTC is saying? I mean, I've seen an estimate that they believe that it's increasing, would increase worker earnings over the next decade by almost $500 billion.
Right. And I think that they're saying what they're suggesting there, and a lot of it's hypothetical, and we'll have to see, but a lot of people are feeling trapped. I consult with people all the time who work for an employer, have thought about taking a job that may pay them more or give them better benefits, but they've got this non-compete and they want to know what their options are. Florida is one of the worst states for employees when it comes to non-competes. Our statute is really one of the harshest in the country. A New York appellate court actually, in an opinion, wrote that it was truly obnoxious the way that it was written. It offended public policy in New York, and they're not the only state who has declined to enforce Florida law when it comes up in a contract.
I'm not clear, though. I thought you said that Florida law explicitly prohibited these.
Florida law explicitly prohibits it, but it has that narrow exception. And what's written into that exception that allows employers to enforce non-competes, they've deemed to be obnoxious. One of the things is the statute specifically states that a judge looking to enforce a non-compete cannot consider the impact that enforcement will have on the individual, so their ability to live and make a living, essentially. The employer, the judge has to completely ignore the impact that it has on the person.
That's fascinating. So when someone comes to you and they have, you know, they're under a non-compete, what advice do you give them?
So there's a few different tools. You know, one is the, well, let's evaluate it and see if it'll actually be enforced. Does it fit within that narrow exception? What are the defenses? And then once you go through the defenses, do we say, okay, take the risk, go and then try your hand if they, you know, sue you and you raise your defenses, and that's what litigation is for. The other side is to go to a judge proactively and try to get a declaratory judgment, declaring that it's unenforceable based on whatever the defenses are or if it exceeds what the statute permits.
When it would be undefensible, I mean, what would a judge be looking at if they're not allowed to look at, for instance, how it might impact your professional career?
Sure. So again, it's the employer's burden to prove that one or more legitimate business interest exists, right? So for instance, if I have the Jimmy John's employee, well, what's the legitimate business interest? Did they receive some kind of specialized training? Did they receive, do they have personal relationships with their customers that they're going to take with them to Subway? What exactly are they asserting? And I think Jimmy John's probably had a tough time coming up with that, which is why they had to end their practice of using them. So that's what you're evaluating, is what's the interest?
And how often do employers sue if somebody just disregards? Because I know that, you know, that does happen. People say, well, I'm not going to observe it. I'm going to go do what I want to do.
Right. It's a big part of our practice. You know, we are constantly in litigation with clients over these types of issues.
Because employers do come after them.
Employers do. And oftentimes, it's a David and Goliath situation. So it may not even necessarily be that they have a very bulletproof argument, but they know that they can afford the litigation. And if they can get a temporary injunction forcing the new employer to fire the employee, how is that employee going to continue to litigate it?
And I would guess if the litigation stretches out long enough, it basically obviates the waiting period. I mean, very often that's like a 6 month, is it?
2 years is, in Florida, 2 years is presumptively reasonable. So, but to your point, even then, yes, we have had these cases go on appeal long past the 2 year mark. And at that point, it's who's going to win, because the winning party gets their attorney's fees.
So the lawsuit that was filed, considered in sort of a friendly appellate circuit, right, in Texas.
That's right.
And you would expect that they're going to seek an injunction. What happens then?
So if a federal judge puts in place an injunction, then the case would be heard on its merits at the trial level. Again, there's a couple of theories here that are going to be at play. There's the major questions doctrine, which is something that the Supreme Court has recently put into place, that says when an administrative agency is making a rule that impacts a major economic issue or a major political issue, that it naturally exceeds its authority. That has to be left to Congress. And so that's what the Chamber of Commerce is going to be arguing. On the other side, the administration is going to be arguing, no, this is under what's called Chevron deference, which is a Chevron case that went to the Supreme Court that said when an agency has a delegated authority, their interpretation of that authority, so long as it's reasonable, the court's going to give deference to it. So we're going to see those two issues, I think, really come together and clash.
Even Chevron's being challenged at the Supreme Court, though.
Chevron is being challenged, yeah. And it looks like that may be beaten back a little bit.
Well, it's a fascinating issue, and I appreciate you being here to answer our questions. James Poindexter, thank you so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And stick around. We'll be back with what's in store for foodies in St. Augustine starting next week.
Amelia Island celebrates Fish to Fork on May 9th through 12th at Omni Amelia Island Resort, featuring fishing and culinary dock-to-dish specialties in a fun, interactive atmosphere. More info at ameliaisland.com/fish-to-fork. Covering Florida, providing confidential assistance for all Floridians looking to explore healthcare coverage options within the federal health insurance marketplace. Help is available at 877-813-9115 or online at coveringflorida.org.
Hi, I'm Daniel Estrin, NPR correspondent in the Middle East. I have spent the past few months covering a devastating war, working with colleagues in Gaza and Israel. NPR has dozens of journalists covering Israeli and Palestinian stories of anguish and survival. When you support this station, you invest in NPR's international coverage. Please give today and help us bear witness.
Visit wjct.org/publicmediadays.
After months of war, the population in Gaza is desperate for humanitarian aid and food. Activists in Turkey say they're organizing an aid flotilla to get assistance to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
It's what we have to do, and for those of us that are willing to do it, we accept the challenges, accept the dangers.
I'm Carol Hills. That story and more next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The Supreme Court takes on presidential immunity. The highest court in the land heard arguments on whether former President Donald Trump is immune from charges related to conspiring to overturn the 2020 election. It's a landmark case and a first for the Supreme Court, but the timing is just as significant. We untangle the Supreme Court's presidential immunity case next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. So food, wine, and the ancient city, it's a pretty good triad, I would say. And here to talk about the fourth annual St. Augustine Food and Wine Festival is Cindy Campbell Taylor, Vice President of the Board at Volano Beach Main Street. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Ann. How are you today?
I'm great. And Chef Sebastian Sikora from La Cochina International Restaurant in St. Augustine.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. How
good
are you?
Morning, Sebastian. So nice to have you.
Thank you.
So we were just talking, you're originally from Chicago.
Yes.
You're a first-generation Polish-American.
Exactly.
How does that background inform your cooking style?
Oh, man. Like we were talking before, I didn't want to embrace it at all. For the longest time, it was like my punishment. And then I wanted to cook every style other than Polish when I first started. And now it's just like I just want to be closer to my family, my roots. So it's just kind of like always my go-back-home type cooking. So that's why I'm always like leaning towards it.
And your parents, your family was a restaurant family.
Yeah, well, not originally. When we moved here from Chicago, we just kind of noticed there was no food of our kind. So my dad was like, in retirement, I'm going to start a new business. So they opened a deli, and that's kind of where it was. And me and my sister were raised in it.
What kind of food were they missing when they opened the restaurant? Like, what was it that they wanted to offer?
Oh, Polish food, kielbasa, pierogi, gołąbki, all the traditional, you know, very comforting foods that we have.
Yeah. And you actually brought a dish with you.
I did.
It is gorgeous.
Thank you.
Tell us what this is.
So this is my play on pimento cheese. So my culinary journey is always going to be on my roots. And me coming down here to the South, I love pimento cheese. So really, it's a potato and cheddar pierogi with pimento coleslaw, and then just a bunch of garnishes to make it look really pretty.
And your mom helps you make your pierogies. I'm going to say it wrong, not nicely. Like
pierogi.
Pierogi.
Yeah, pierogi. She does. It's my favorite time to bond with her.
Are they labor intensive?
Absolutely. But for us, it's like we just start talking, and before we know it, we've got a couple hundred under our belt. So
always different on the inside, or?
Usually we try to stay pretty traditional, especially if my mom's involved. The moment I try to slide in an untraditional one, like potato and cheddar, she's like, oh no, how'd you get this one?
So Cindy, you're a bit of a foodie yourself.
I am. Yes.
So this is a 5-day festival, I think?
It is. It's a 5-day festival throughout St. Augustine with the primary events happening out at World Golf Village.
Okay. And so if somebody, this is the fourth of them?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And so how is the Volano Beach community involved? Because that's the board that you represent.
Yes. And actually, so with St. Augustine Food and Wine and the sister event that we have, which is Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife, Volano Beach Main Street is actually the charity of choice. So AdFish, who manages both of those events, selected Volano Beach Main Street as their charity. So we, again, are the charity, and a donation is made to Volano Beach Main Street, as well as we have the silent auction that happens at both of those events, with 100% of those proceeds going to Volano Beach. And all of that is placed within the community. I would say from those four events, as well as after this year, and then Whiskey, Wine, and Wildlife, they will have donated over $75,000 to the community.
Wow. So I want to ask you about the silent auction in a minute, but the Volano Beach Main Street, for people who aren't familiar, what is that?
Yeah, so there is an actual national Main Street program, and there's a Florida Main Street program. There's over 52 small communities, not all small actually, throughout the state of Florida that are official Main Streets. And basically what that means is we do dedication to the community as it relates to history and businesses, really to help promote businesses that come into our main streets. We also are there to help represent our residents. So it's really, it's a nice balance between a commercial aspect, making sure that we're preserving historical areas, conservation, and then making sure that the residents have a quality of life. And in Volano Beach, we say that we really have, we're proud to have that small beach town vibe.
Yeah. And people may not remember, but Volano Beach, you know, there was a time when the bridge that connects Volano to St. Augustine went through sort of the main street of Volano Beach. And when they did the new bridge, it bypassed that area, and it had an impact.
It did. And what was great about that road is now we have the pier. So part of that was preserved, the old road, and that is now the fishing pier. So it did have an impact. But then with all of the work that has been done over the last, really, I would say 30 years in Volano Beach, particularly the last 2 to 4 years, where we've really been focused on reviving that area, as you said, and really just bringing life back to Volano Beach.
Sebastian, I want to ask you, there's something called Harvest Awards.
Yes.
What are those?
So the Harvest Awards are going to be at Bozard Ford in Lincoln. And the base of the competition itself is to source local ingredients and then bring all the talented chefs together to try to compete to see who's got the best dish.
And what's your local ingredient going to be?
Blueberries.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say dattle pepper, but
no, blueberries. It's right. Just the perfect time for them.
Well, Cindy Campbell-Taylor, Sebastian Sercora, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fun at the festival. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, or you can find our entire archive at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Join us Tuesday for our monthly Ask the Mayor segment, when Jacksonville Mayor Donna Deegan joins us to answer your questions. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect, WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.